Today's episode of Nerder, She Wrote is brought to you by Remarkably Remote, a new daily microcast from the experts at GoToMeeting, all about making work from home work for you. With indispensable intel on how to stay sane, motivated, and productive at home, we're here to help you in this brave new remote working world. Find us on smart speakers or subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. You can also listen at gotomeeting.com/tips. That's gotomeeting.com/tips.
Welcome to the Back to Back Pod on the Athletic Podcast Network. This is Nerder, She Wrote with your host, Dave Dufour, with Mo DeKeel and Seth Partnow.
Are you ready to be entertained?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Nerder, She Wrote on the Back to Back Podcast on the Athletic Podcast Network. I'm your host, Dave Dufour, joined as I am every single week by Mo DeKeel and Seth Partnow. From the jump, we wanted to follow the Athletic's lead and we want to highlight a local business, and Seth has come up with some ad copy for one of his favorite places in Milwaukee.
It might not necessarily be one of my favorite places, but it's certainly one of the most important places for the health and welfare of my family. For work-at-home parents in the Milwaukee area, Little Sprouts Play Cafe is a perfect spot to get some work done, enjoy a cup of coffee while your small children occupy themselves with creative play. Now that schools, offices, and of course, play cafes are closed at the moment, Little Sprouts is making parents' lives easier with local pickup and delivery of books, activity kits, and birthday boxes. And this week, especially Easter baskets. Check them out at littlesproutsplaycafe.com.
And I just want to put the all call out there. If you're a listener of the show, if you've got a small business or a restaurant or something that you would like us to highlight, you know, this is a national show. We will highlight your business anywhere. It doesn't just have to be in one of the places we live. But now let's talk some basketball. Seth, how many people were angry about your column on offensive styles and how they've changed or not?
I got the one kind of regular way to make basketball boring comment. But other than that, the comment seems like it's like clockwork. There's one of those. It's like you read this whole article just to say that. Thank you.
Well, I don't know if you know this, Seth, but nobody wants to look at graphs when they're talking.
Nobody. That's true. I've made an entire career of people not wanting to look at stuff I've done. So that makes sense. No, I kid. The response was pretty positive. It sort of felt like more of an intro than a fully formed piece to me, but the response has been pretty good.
I have to say, like, I was reading through the comments, I am shocked by the level of discourse in the comments on your articles. Like, people actually know what they're talking about. I mean, there's points per chance cited in the comments. Like, where does that happen?
Well, I mean, isn't that kind of the Athletic fan base too? And, you know, yeah, the Seth Partnow fan base is, I would expect that from the Seth fan base. Like, I would be disappointed otherwise, unless it's me going in there going like, so what's this PPP thing, this points per possession thing? I would be a little bit disappointed.
So how is the league changed?
First of all, there's the one kind of surprising thing actually to me. You can divide, this is using Synergy data going back to 2004. So for a number of reasons, Synergy data isn't perfect. It wasn't designed as a quote data source so much as more of a scouting platform, but in broad terms, it's useful. So the kinds of things that end scoring chances in the half court have been about 50-50 between on-ball actions, where, you know, it's the guy with the ball in a pick and roll, a guy ISOing, a guy posting up, increasingly a guy coming off of a handoff or a DHO. Possessions have been used about 50-50 between those kinds of plays and kind of spot-up shots, coming off screens, getting the ball off a cut or a dump off, stuff like that. Basically, it's been 50-50 or thereabouts consistently for the last 16 years. Now, the mix of the on-ball actions has changed a fair amount, but it was surprising to me that, you know, there's still about half the time the guy with the ball is responsible for, you know, whatever happening, and about half the time someone else does something, if that makes sense.
I mean, it's kind of matches the eye test.
I was just surprised the fact that it was the consistency, that it was like between like 48 and 51% were on ball actions like every year, like clockwork. And even as the, like I said, the mix has changed. There's obviously, I mean, it's not, it won't surprise anyone to know that there are far more pick and rolls now and fewer ISOs and especially post-ups than there used to be. But those are kind of, they're kind of trading off against each other. They're not taking away from kind of the other sorts of plays. And the other sorts of plays have kind of held pretty constant among themselves.
And because of some of these things, post-ups are actually slightly more efficient, correct?
I mean, that's sort of a selection bias, I think, in that they are, because it's happening less, a greater proportion of post-ups are Joel Embiid. Right. So, you know.
But they're your best post-up guys. Like, right. It's him. It's Brooke Lopez. It's guys that can actually score out.
Right.
LeBron
right.
was absurd in the post this year. So
amazing this year.
So, like, you're not posting up. God, who's a crappy one we could name?
Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah, exactly. You're not posting up Porzingis and on a regular basis, so he's not going to be dragging the numbers down because there's not that many possessions of it.
Right. It's not necessarily that it's the selection bias of who gets to do it now, much more than any. You can, that's something you can kind of see in a lot of different stats across basketball, is when something starts to be done very rarely, the efficiency actually spikes. Like, for example, mm-hmm. This is something I've noticed.
Well, it's a curveball.
Yeah. But it's something I've noticed is that, like, sometimes you'll find that teams that never get out in transition actually have a really high efficiency in transition. And it's because that since they're not really looking to run, the times they run are like mm-hmm. when the other team falls down. So it's like, yeah, you got a breakaway. So that you're
right.
You know, that the other team falls down or whatever, just completely falls asleep, you know, roughly the same amount against every team. But if you're running a lot, that's a smaller percentage of your transition chances versus if you're running like extremely selectively. So it makes you look more efficient, even though you're not actually doing it that often.
I wonder if part of why the Spurs seem to be so great at actually making threes, like a high percentage of their threes, comes from the fact that defenses don't worry about the three ball as much with them. I mean, clearly they also hunt for great shot over good shot, but do you think that might play a part of it?
Sure. I'd have to dig in a little bit more. Sorry, Mo. I'd have to dig in a little bit more to see how what the mix of shot attempts looks like. But it's certainly possible. And it's also, there's a certain amount.
I just always think styles makes fights. Right?
And there's a certain amount of year-to-year variance. And like, not this past season, but the season before when they led the league in three-point shooting. I think that was A, Bertans, B, some like a slightly unsustainable degree of overall accuracy from their players.
But it also goes to like what David was saying though too, of like them hunting specifically going from good to great threes and trying to get the open looks. Like I'd be interested in seeing the data of how many of theirs are open looks, whereas like, I mean, I've watched a ton of Houston, you know, this past year, and you know, a lot of those threes, even some of the ones of the guys where you're like, yeah, Austin Rivers, you shouldn't be shooting this contested three. Like, that's not your game. That's not, you know, like they're getting a lot of high numbers out of it, but it's like, you know, so like I can understand where like the Spurs would have a high percentage just because they're so much more selective in that not everybody has a green light. Whereas in Houston, it's, you know, I could be on the team and have a green light. And I'll be honest with you folks, I should have a yellow.
The Spurs are like Ansel Adams, right? They set things up. Whereas the Rockets are more like what photographers would refer to as spray and pray. Like we're just gonna throw the ball at the basket a lot,
right?
And not necessarily worry if it's a great look or a good look or even an okay look, and hope it goes in. And I think, you know, that's the one pushback against the high variance game that they play. Is so many of those shots are just bad.
I wrote early in the year about this. This is something I was noticing. Actually, I was looking at kind of the at the Bucks at the kind of early in the season. We're taking a lot of kind of mediocre early shot clock threes, and they kind of got away from it after about the first, I want to say 15, 20 games of the season. But looking at the league as a whole, there was a rise in these kind of the very mediocre middle to early shot clock three. And I think that's where you're starting to see kind of pushing up against the edge of what is the upper bound of three-point attempts that you can start to take. I think we've talked about this before. I think that the overall league will continue to shoot more and more, but that's going to be much more about
yes.
the bottom rising in terms of catching up rather than Houston suddenly finding a way to consistently take, you know, 60% of their shots from three or something like that. Because I think that
Yeah, this idea that they're going to do what they did with the Rio Grande Vipers and have, like, you know, a team averaging 55 or 63s a game, I just don't think that's going to be possible.
Yeah, I mean,
because the defense will just completely adjust.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's possible. I just think it's not going to win. The returns, like, you get beyond even diminishing returns, and you get into the area of, like, negative returns where you start to.
Have you done the math on this? Like, what's the number where it actually the returns do diminish?
It's not that straightforward because it depends on who's shooting, how you're shooting, and we don't, certainly with public data, we don't have a good way of modeling, like, replacement, like what shot you're replacing. I think it's a little bit there's a little bit of guesswork, and this is something that has been
sure.
This has been a discussion for a long time kind of in the community. Is I think there's no reason to think that, certainly on a player level, I don't think that that, like, three-point aggression leads to kind of a linearly declining results. I think there's a certain point where there's, like, a cliff. It's like, okay, you can shoot those shots, but not these other shots. And you get a point where, all right, you're taking all the ones you can reasonably make, and any additional ones you add are going to be really low value. I think there's likely a discontinuity there that makes, you know, actually modeling it pretty difficult.
Yeah, that'd be a hard one, I think, to figure out, just because the whole variable of everything that can happen, and
right,
you know, who's guarding you, what, everything.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, I mean, if your additional threes are all being taken by Terrence Ross, who doesn't care. He's kind of a,
right.
No, but he's, but it would, it, like, Terrence Ross or Troy Daniels Gerald Green or something like that, who's like, you know, are kind of like, I'm going to shoot no matter what, and I can reasonably make them when they're tightly contested. Like, then there might be some, like, the decline might be more gradual. But if you have guys who have kind of, you know,
either of us doing it,
what's that?
If you have Westbrook shooting it.
Well, not just Westbrook, but even a guy who is a good open shooter, but, like, say, like a Malcolm Brogdon, a guy who's a good open shooter, but his mechanics make it such that it's difficult for him to be a good contested shooter. Like, that's not going to be, like, a gradual drop off in terms of, like, his 3-point rate versus his efficiency. There's going to be a cliff there. Because it's like he's open and then he's not open, and it's going to be a big difference between the two.
And see, this is why, like, I appreciate the analytics and the science part of it, but I always fall back on the fact that basketball is more like art, and the science can give us more information, but because of all these changing variables, it's impossible to predict.
Well, you have to know what you're looking at from the basketball to actually plug in, like, the right variables. You know, you have to right. kind of have a sense of where that, like, that cutoff line might be to examine, like, which players, you know, can shoot when contested and semi-contested, like our, you know, like our guy Bertans, and which guys, you know, just have to be open.
Davis Bertans is, like, the most unconscious player in the league. It's funny that you mentioned Gerald Green and Terrence Ross, but I put Davis above them. Even.
No, it's more just like the track record of guys just not caring where the defense is. I'm shooting.
Well, it's like Duncan Robinson had said recently, or I read somewhere, where he's just like, I know the amount of space I need. So what it looks like, we're like, damn, I can't believe he's getting this shot off. It's like, no, he knows he has the space he needs. Like, I can't imagine Davis Bertans feels like, I don't need any space. I could shoot from a phone inside the phone booth. Like, you know,
being 6'10" helps. Kind of,
does help, but even just like a small phone booth, like at the airport, right, where you really got to squeeze in, you know, like, I just feel like he's letting that up with no conscience, and the amazing fact is how often it goes in.
No, and but I think that if you talk to most players, they you would have them say, yeah, I know how much room I need to get the shot off. The thing is with those guys, the answer is none. I need none room because I know I mean,
everybody thinks they're better at it than they, right? Everybody, I mean, always,
yeah,
thinks they need,
yeah,
none.
It's like, I mean, like, you know, obviously, like, you know, we're talking about, again, you talk about, like, Gerald Green, that's the extreme of no conscience. But, like, again, NBA players generally make pretty good decisions about, like, their own abilities, because if you don't, you don't end up in the NBA, or you don't end up playing very much, because, like, you know, it's very glaringly obvious when a guy is trying to do stuff he can't do.
That part's very true. We can definitely see that.
I'm pulling up PJ Tucker's stats. PJ Tucker this season on wide open, which is 6 or more feet, which we've talked about before. The tracking data on NBA.com, not amazing.
It's not that, no, it's
but he's at 39.7.
The data is fine. The labeling is imperfect.
Right, right. So 6 or more feet is the only thing we'll accept as open. 39.7%. 2 to 4 feet, 10%. 4 to 6 feet, 31%. And so let's just look at it at 4 to 6. That's a normal contest in the NBA. Drops to 8 percentage points.
Can you, Dave, can you do me a favor? Can you look up his number from last year? Just because this year he's had a lot of shoulder problems too. So I don't know how much that's skewing the data. I don't know. I don't see what it is.
You know what? That's a good eye. He was 40% in that 4 to 6 range last year, and 37. So clearly he's altered his
he's having shoulder injuries, and that stuff that also goes into these things, right? Like that's a hard part with all of this.
So the other part of that,
the previous season was about 38.
The thing you need to take into account with that is also just the volume. I mean, if you look at him,
it's low volume, less than one a game
of the like,
or right around one.
And that almost tells you as much of as anything else. Like if a guy is not shooting except he's open, he's telling you that he needs to be open to shoot.
Well, his shot is a little bit slow, and he gets a lot of time to set up. He's wide open in the corner often. But
he also has a fairly extreme like, and it's probably related to that a little bit. He has a pretty extreme like corner above the break split. Also, if we're talking about
Yeah, like you can leave him wide open above the break.
That gets into
nobody's worried about him.
So we're bouncing very far afield, but we're here. So let's go.
Sure.
No, but
I mean,
this is what the show is. This is a theory that I don't think corner 3-point ability is actually a top line skill. I think it's a condiment, not an actual piece of the dish, if that makes sense. Just because
it's ketchup, not the burger.
Yeah. It's not the fries either. It's, you know, it's because the volume on that is just so low, and it's actually pretty replaceable in terms of the variety of guys you can kind of stick in the corner and then be reasonably competent from there. And so that's why like above the break is really like if a guy is a floor spacer, that means he can make above the break threes. Like being competent in the corner is fine, but it's like that's like the ante rather than like actually bringing something to the table.
You hear that, Dave? Corner threes don't matter anymore.
Here's the deal. I get that. Like, I completely get that idea that the above the break three is a more valuable skill if someone has it. But the truth is, not everybody has it. And so, like, you still want someone who's really competent in the corner just because so much good offense ends up with the ball in the corner for an open look. So you're not I'm trying to, like, put words in your mouth, kind of. You're not devaluing the corner three. You're saying that being able to make the corner three is less valuable than the above the break. Correct.
I think I am devaluing it a little bit in terms of guys say, oh, he can stretch out to the corner, and I'm kind of at this point sort of so what? Like you're not actually, because again, the volume of corner threes that teams can get up in a game is so low that like and the distribution the ability to make them at a reasonable enough rate is so widely distributed across rosters that like that's kind of a so what in terms of a guy having like genuine offensive impact.
I know it will
if that's all you can do, that's not great.
Well, you never, I mean, in general in basketball now at this point, if you just do one thing, that's not good anymore. You need to be able to have a couple of tools in your basket. If you're just a corner three, if you're just an above the break three, although that might be more valuable than being just a corner three guy.
Well, no, if you can make above the break threes, you can probably make corner threes too. So
it's right. I was just making a point, Seth. If you just do one thing, it's just killing me. Oh God, I'm trying to help you out here, bud. You just said corner threes don't matter, and I hope aggregators take you for that one.
I don't think I did say that.
That's what I heard, Dave. Did you hear? That's what I heard.
I actually wanted to clarify it because I know people might jump on that. And that, yeah. So the other thing we wanted to talk about today, aside from Seth's piece on The Athletic, which you can read if you subscribe.
But before we move, on, what's the follow up piece? What do you have? Do you have a next? This is just kind of like the intro piece, yeah. Right? Like, we'll talk about that
next week.
Yeah, but I want a preview. I want to start studying. Okay.
So the thing I'm looking into next is looking at the variety across teams. There's again this pervasive notion that everyone's playing the same now. And, you know, this data is an imperfect proxy for how teams play, but it gets us somewhere. And at least in initial investigation that I feel pretty good in, I can say that the variation among teams in terms of how they get to offense isn't any smaller than it's been across that time period. And depending on how you want to look at it, is actually a decent bit. There's actually a decent bit more variation. So, like, again, I don't want to, if there are things that people find displeasing aesthetically about the modern game, like, you have to credit that. However, if what they're telling you is something they don't like isn't actually happening, then you have to do a little bit more investigation. Because, again, the notion that everyone is playing the same doesn't really hold up to scrutiny, I don't think. So there's something else going on, and we can figure out what that is. But if there is a problem people have with, you know, what they're watching now, we do owe it to find out exactly what it is that they're having a problem with so we can fix it. But everyone playing the same isn't actually happening.
I'm looking forward to that, because I agree with you on that, Seth, for sure. I'm excited for that article.
Okay, so now the other thing that we wanted to talk about, because it's really that time of year, is the draft. And I'm not ready to talk about any of the prospects. I've watched very little of them. I've done more reading about them from, you know, Sam Vecenie and other draft folks that I trust. But more the actual reality of this year's draft and the fact that it is going to be stats and video. That, as of right now, I don't know how they even do a combine.
I mean, they're not going to.
You can't. Yeah. I mean, you just can't under the circumstances we have. I'm not sure, 100% sure, they're going to have this draft in June. Like, I won't be surprised if they push
it. Oh, no.
Like,
it's too short.
I won't be surprised if they push this to like, August or September. I don't know. I'm just throwing out a random month that I'm just happy I can name a few. But I don't expect them to have this thing in June because of stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of things that go into this, and I think teams are worried about just doing the drafting just off video and stats and whatever they get in the 4-hour interviews that they get to have with these guys.
Well, Seth, you just came from an NBA front office, and so you are familiar with the process. How different do you think it's going to be this year?
I mean, I think it is going to be harder, certainly. I think that the area where it's going to be materially just worse and lead to some more uncertainty and perhaps quote-unquote mistakes is on the medical side. There's without the combine, without the ability to kind of get guys in and put them through, like, the battery of tests that that teams' medical staffs do. That's the part where there's going to be some guesswork, some uncertainty, maybe some skittishness, especially as we've kind of seen over the last couple of years. I don't think it's much of a secret. I think Tom Haberstroh has written about this a lot,
right,
that because of the specialization and volume of play that these guys are getting at a young age, like, there's a lot of, like, ticking time bombs from a joint standpoint about guys coming into the draft now, and not being able to identify that beforehand is a little bit frightening, frankly. So that's a part where it's going to be just, like, worse. In terms of the evaluation of the player as a player, I'm not so certain how much not being able to work a guy out is going to actually hurt. I think there's a lot of noise there. In a workout, how much signal there is, I don't don't know.
I think that's where we disagree, though, because I think there is a lot of value in bringing these guys in for the workout. Not necessarily in the, okay, he hit whatever. We used to do the Spurs 100. We had a whole three-point shooting drill, a range of different threes. And
what do you shoot in the Spurs 100, by the way, Mo? I know you used to do it.
What did I? No, I definitely have done it. What was the best I ever did? I'm not a great shooter. I'm when the game's on the line, shot maker, but I'm probably not a guy that's going to make the shot in the first or second quarter.
Sorry, I'm not a great shooter. I'm just very clutch.
Yeah, so no, I am clutch.
Were you literally 40s, Chip, 50s,
Chip
or 60s?
England has said that exactly to me. Chip, probably about like in the 40s. Okay. I'm not that good. But okay. Chip England has said that exact thing to me, Dave, so take that.
By the way, explain the Spurs 100. Please.
I'm not going to run through every drill, but it's different than what we wanted to do. Was we wanted to develop a different workout than shoot 25 threes from the corner or whatever it was, like mm-hmm. 25 from the corner, 25 from the above the break, top of the key, above whatever. We wanted to change this up a bit. So we did a whole bunch of things. It was a series of stuff that was spot shots, off the dribble, coming off screens, coming off flares, running into transition, you know, threes and things like that. So it was a range of it. So we kind of got a
escape dribble,
an idea, escape dribble.
It was a real workout.
It was a real workout.
A real workout.
And the real thing that was incredibly hard about it was we would do this at the end of a draft workout. So these guys have gone on, have done all sorts of exercises, have done 3-on-3 in several different weird scenarios that you put them in. And then we would put them in the Spurs 100 thing. That's just exhausting. And you know, and the thing was, you know, part of it was like we wanted to see guys, you know, competitive spirit. It wasn't so much we wanted to see, oh, this guy killed this guy in the 3-on-3 workout or whatever drill we were doing. We wanted to see how these guys reacted to it. We wanted to see how, which guy was picking up guys on his team, which guy was kind of getting frustrated with his teammates and trying to just go it on his own. What guy would just quit? What guy would compete and things like that? There's a great article from Keith Smith that he just posted talking about GMs who are talking about this very subject. And one of the things in there, a story in there was like, they had a guy, one of the executives was talking about it, had a guy go through a shooting drill. He shot terribly. He got pissed off and asked to do it again. And they kind of just loved the competitive spirit behind that. And I think those are the kind of things you can't get off video. You don't get off stats. You can call coaches and get background information, but those people have angles, right? Like, yo, John Calipari wants his guys to go in the lottery, right? So like it makes him look good. So those guys are going to tell you what they need to tell you. You're not getting honest brokers, you know, when you're getting feedback from these coaches or their agents and things like that. So I think that's the most important thing in the draft workouts that teams aren't going to get. It's not so much what they actually did in the workout. It's how they reacted to things and that stuff. And I think that matters a lot as well.
So it's a little bit of a gut check, IQ check, conditioning check, mentality test.
So yes and no. I would say that it's also like, you know, agents aren't dummies either. And there's some coaching that goes into it. Like they've kind of, you know, I think that agents have a sense for what people want to hear. And so right. there's a certain amount of learning that goes on in terms of presenting well in those situations. That's you do kind of the guys who are with a big agency versus with a more independent guy. You can sometimes you're picking more up on the coaching than you are in differences between the players, I would say. And by coaching, I don't mean like the coaching that they got in college. I mean the coaching that they got like in interviewing.
Right, going into the workout, going in, like, you know, they're coming in going like, be ready, you're going to San Antonio, they have the Spurs 100, you know, like all sorts of, they're going to talk to you about this stuff in the interview. Seth's 100% right in the coaching that the agents give these guys going into the pre-draft workout stuff when they're walking into a organization's facility for the first time to basically a audition for a job, and that's what it is. I just think there's a lot of interesting things you could find in interesting things teams can take away from that value of that workout and those conversations with guys. And even just doing it on Skype, like I used to do Skype interviews for a living. Like I used to recruit tech guys based on Skype interviews. And that was hard as hell. Like, you know, then they would go to the company that we'd send them to and the company would just tell us stuff. And I'm like, huh, you can't pick up everything in just a video interview. You know, in person, you get to see a little more things up close and stuff like that. So I think this is a very tough draft environment for teams because I think there's just everything's a piece to the puzzle. The draft workouts aren't the end all be all. Like you can't place everything in that. You can't place everything in video. You can't place everything in the stats. Like I think they all go together to kind of tell you what you're getting with this guy. And I think it's, I mean, if I'm a team, I'd be terrified right now drafting. And this is a scary draft to begin with. Like,
but draft Twitter has been doing this is, you know, I don't want to get too deep on Twitter, but draft Twitter has been doing film and stats analysis basically the entire time. I don't think a lot of those guys are going and seeing guys in person. They're definitely not doing individual workouts.
That'd be a hell of a thing. This would be a good individual draft Twitter funny, right? workout. LaMelo Ball walking into the LA Fitness for the draft Twitter workout.
Might have to use that idea. Mike Smells might want to cut that one out for me, please. Thanks. But so it is kind of an interesting test case for, you know, how do you proceed going forward? Like, what if teams actually decide, you know what, this isn't bad. Maybe this is enough.
I don't know. I don't think you're going to have that from teams. Teams are always going to want the most information you can possibly get. I mean, Seth already touched on the importance of the medical side of it alone. But I just think teams are always going to want more information. And I know you get worried about, you know, you do have situations where a coach will fall in love with a prospect and the front office has got to be like, no, dude, you can't be, no, like that's not the guy we're drafting or whatnot. You run into those issues. And I think every team has had that at one point or another. And that tends to make the challenges of drafting challenging in that sense. But that's why you got to kind of just have your core guys and your coach has got to trust that your front office has been on top of this for seeing these guys the past few years and things like that. So I think they're always going to want more information though, Dave. I just can't see a team, you know, with that being readily available, just going like, nah, we're good.
So I'd be terrible because I would say, man, I really love this kid from Villanova.
Every time.
Every single draft. Every draft.
I mean, you know, the yes.
Listen, Jay Wright is a very good coach.
Yeah.
He coaches, like, that's role player university.
Jalen Brunson, baby. I'm a big fan.
Well, I do think so. I think the danger is you get into, oh, this guy's a winner, and that's why. But what is the thing that the Villanova guys strongly tend to have that we've talked about before? That is an important thing, especially for perimeter players in today's game, is they have great body strength. Like you look at the guys coming out like aside from maybe like, you know, Mikhail Bridges, who has other obvious physical attributes, like everyone else who's come out of Villanova recently is strong, is in there.
Monster.
And like you go from Josh Hart to Dante DiVincenzo to Jalen Brunson to, you know, if you're talking about like, okay, you're not going to get physically overmatched on the floor. If you're going with a Villanova guy,
is UVA another school that's kind of like that?
I don't think Ty Jerome is very good, so no.
The hemming and hawing was the answer.
Yeah. No, but see, but that's like, but no, but so that's like that. That's actually like an interesting, is it? Because you know when Virginia's had guys who had that, you know, your Joe Harris's, your Malcolm Brogdon's. Like, you know, right. It's like, okay, they've done well, but then you like, how does Ty Jerome, like, okay, Ty Jerome might be a quote winner at the college level, but is he like, there's not much we saw this year that would dissuade you from the kind of the pre-draft opinion that he physically just can't do it. Like, you know, it's a step too far for him because of, you know, physical limitations and not just his like, you know, lack of quickness, but he's also like small and not very physically strong. And so that's, you know, it's the characteristic that is not necessarily some like magic sauce that a program has. Though the Villanova strength and conditioning coach might be the magic sauce here.
Oh no, that's interesting. See, it's funny because we always just think about the player, but maybe that guy might have just figured something out.
So. Well, like, no, but, you know, you talk about it and, like, the guys who you know that a guy from Villanova has been in a program, and if a guy from UNC, like, maybe he has, maybe he hasn't, but it's more about the kid and less so about the what they're doing as a program.
Yeah. I might see if we can get Jay Wright to come on and talk about it. I'd be curious to see how much he recruits guys that are close to where they need to be, or whether he trusts the team that he's put together to build these guys. Might be an interesting thing to talk about.
There's probably some of both. Like, he probably like looks for toughness, and then like the program for across various ways like hones it even further.
Yeah, and then, you know, getting these guys into a proper strength conditioning program as well to help build that body strength and things like that. That's also going to help in that situation, because you're not getting that in high school.
Yeah, very, very rarely. I mean, if you play football, you get a bad version of it.
Right. You know, it's
at least 20 something years ago.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, tweet at us, guys, if that's changed in high school. It's been a long time since I've been in high school. So
we are going to do up downs until Blue is no longer tired and thirsty.
we were talking about this the other night, that we grew up, we were like the last group that had to do football practice in July and August. And I mean, I was in Virginia, where it was, you know, routinely 100 degrees with 100% humidity, and you couldn't just get water whenever you wanted. We were also drinking out of a water hose with, you know, 40 other guys. Disgusting.
I wonder how that would go now in the new COVID 19 era.
It's not happening. It's over. Those days are done.
Let's ask Mike Gundy what he thinks. Let's not ask Mike Gundy.
Oh, don't get me started on that. That's not a nerder she wrote topic.
No. Well, it might be. But no, all right. So what are you guys doing this week coming up? Do weeks exist anymore?
It's weird. I mark my days, my weeks, based on the Law and Order marathon on the Sundance channel that goes on Thursday and Friday. That's how I know what day of the week it is.
I mark my days with this podcast. I know we're recording every Wednesday, sometime in the early afternoon.
It's just
if I just hang out near my computer long enough, I'll get a text from Mo. Hey, I'm on.
Yeah, somebody will call at some point, right? Just leave Skype on. Somebody's going to call. You know, but this week I am, as you guys would be shocked to know, I'm diving into old basketball, taking a look at some of the guys in the 90s era. And hopefully we'll have something out in the next week or two.
As long as you're not about to tell us that Karl Malone wasn't good at basketball.
Oh, my God.
Okay. Dude, don't tell people what I'm working on, Dave.
No, I know what you're talking about, Dave, and come on.
Like, yeah. No. I know. That's just people, listen. I'm sorry. Like, if you're under 30, maybe under 35, like, I just don't know if you can talk about Karl Malone.
Like, come on, guys. Like, any, like, let's stop that. Like, dude, I don't want to even get started on that. That was just stupid.
Yeah. My hot take has always been that Stockton was a better player than Karl Malone was. But that's like,
yes.
Okay. It's like, okay, so it, among the top 50 players of all time, one of them ranks higher than the other. Like
right. Like, what are we?
No, the listen, and not to again, this is just spending too much time on Twitter. The argument being that he mastered the pick and roll, and that's why he was so good. The pick and roll is fundamental to the game of basketball.
Oh, so he was just good at like the basic action of the modern NBA.
Yeah.
So therefore,
he was really good. Seth, you're leaving this out. He was just really good at making the ball go through the hoop. That's it. Wasn't great. Just really, really good at it.
The funny thing is when we stat guys criticize a guy for, yeah, he just scores and doesn't do anything else. It's like, go watch the games.
Right.
DeMar DeRozan's averaging 25 a game. How can you not like him? And then, but now, anyway, don't give me rabble, rabble.
I think with that, though, it's because you guys are nitpicking. This is just the person's an idiot. with the stat guys saying that DeMar, like, and by the way, no stat guy that I respect said he was a bad basketball player at all. Because clearly DeMar DeRozan is not bad at basketball.
He's an ineffective NBA player.
We might disagree on this.
Okay, let's go. At a championship level or a championship contention level play,
there he's an
ineffective player.
Okay, yeah. Fair.
Like, yeah. He's sort of depending on what you need, if you need to fill, if you're a mediocre team that needs to fill possessions and needs an innings eater, great. If you actually want to, you know, go to the conference finals.
Yeah. So you're predicting that he's going to opt out and sign with the Knicks.
that'd be pretty perfect.
All right. So what are you doing this week?
I am in the process of writing the follow-up to the offensive styles piece. We did a fun little thing where me and a baseball, football, and hockey writer got together and drafted things from other sports. That should be coming out later this week or early next week, I think. Listeners of this pod will not be surprised in the least by any of my selections. I'm also, as part of our like Athletic Goes local thing, I'm writing about my my spot here in Milwaukee that hopefully can make it through these times because if no other reason, I got to take Dave here next time he comes here because it's a wrestling bar. So
I don't have any interest. At first I was offended that you were just going to take Dave, and I was like, yo, what the hell? And then when you said it was wrestling, I was like, I'm good.
Yeah.
So I've watched WrestleMania. And it's the first wrestling I've watched in like 10 years, maybe even more. And it was interesting. It was, I didn't hate it. There was some really great stuff, but I did a podcast, with my friend Ben Cruz. I think that's going to come out the same day as this show. So, if you want to hear me talk about wrestling, I actually tell kind of a little bit of like old wrestling stories on that show. But it was fun and it was interesting. That's it. That's all I'm doing. It's just like doing my normal routine. My life hasn't really changed all that much, except I don't get to go out to my favorite restaurants and I'm not watching basketball. That's it. Everything else is pretty much the same.
Okay.
Please leave that awkward silence in. Anyway, that's it for this week, folks. Catch us next week with more Nerdish She Wrote.